Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
I was giving a course, a one-hour course at the Pennsylvania Bar Institute, and somebody said, can you describe mediation in one word? And I didn't hesitate. I didn't blink. I said opportunity. I actually start mediations. I love the initial joint session where I go over the ground rules where people haven't been in mediations, and every one I do is different. And I sometimes throw that question out, and the answer I get is negotiations, facilitation, communications. And there are many one words that could describe mediation, but I think opportunity just nails it.
It nails it.
Ben Picker is a mediator, a mediation trainer, and till recently was the chair of the Philadelphia law firm Stradley Ronan's ADR Practice Group, winner of CPR's 2007 ADR Excellence Award. We will have an upcoming episode about Stradley Ronan and how they won this award, but really wanted to present Ben Picker and Ben's philosophy about mediation and what that means for litigants and negotiators. Ben is a longtime supporter of CPR and has written several articles in Alternatives magazine. He has, as a mediator, resolved several hundred disputes involving billions of dollars. He's the author of the Mediation Practice Guide, a handbook for resolving business disputes. And as somebody who's read and admired Ben Picker's work over the years, I can simply say you can't read a Ben Picker article and not come away with enthusiasm for mediation. In this podcast, Ben describes his mediation philosophy and the common mistakes he sees negotiators make in overlooking or failing to take advantage of opportunity.
It's an opportunity to do so many things. It's an opportunity, for example, early on in a dispute, to telescope issues in hours that will take years. Keep in mind, we don't need all that tons of discovery to make an intelligent settlement decision. It's an opportunity to get the parties together and create an event. Without that event, we have often sliding negotiations. It dissipates. It's an opportunity to manage effective communications, to get behind the dispute, to talk about not just what parties need and what they want and what they think is fair, right, or true, although there's no truth. There's only a court truth that may or may not be the truth or what happened. And parties see different things anyway when they look at the same thing. But ultimately, and it's also an opportunity to save time and money, it's an opportunity to solve the problem. Ultimately, it's an opportunity to create a solution that's not even available in a litigation or in arbitration. And for all those reasons, it's an enormous opportunity, and I talk about it, and I set people up, and they know it in the beginning by talking about opportunity, and I say, but that opportunity can't be achieved unless you're willing to listen to each other respectfully, make good judgments, make good decisions, and be willing even to concede some points. And I often get back to that introductory comment in the joint session when I'm meeting with parties in caucus sessions, and people don't want to lose an opportunity. Right. That's part of the frame. We talk a lot about framing, and parties show that all the studies, and there are great studies on negotiations done in the last 10 years, primarily, interestingly, in the business schools, more than the law schools, on negotiating behavior. The studies show that parties are very protective of what they regard as gains, but will take unreasonable risks in the face of paying monies on a current basis they might regard as a loss. And any payment might be regarded as a loss. So we start that frame with the word opportunity, but I truly believe there's an opportunity. I think most parties, once they get into the process, see that opportunity. Preserving relationships, the list goes on and on and on.
But opportunity to me is as good as the lawyer who's, you know, I wind up managing the dispute if we don't settle, okay? So what opportunity says to me, and why I immediately love the way you describe this, is you turn the dispute around and you say, if we don't settle here, we will get an outcome. It's not like it's settlement or nothing. No, it's we already know that there is an end to this, and it's an end that has costs associated with it. It's an outcome that we may be able to predict with a reasonable degree of certainty as to what that outcome will be, when it will be delivered, the cost to us, both in terms of the resolution cost, but also the relationship impact that it may have. So if you can quantify that and just think of it in simple terms, if I can put a number on that, what is the cost to me of not resolving this conflict? Whether that's, a lost relationship with a customer, everything that you just said, give it the negative version of it and say, I know that I will get that outcome if I don't settle. So what is my opportunity today to do better than that?
You've just reminded me of my wife. You want to know why?
I hope that she's prettier.
She's far lovelier than you.
Thank you.
Meaning no disrespect. My wife's a great artist. She's a really fabulous artist. And I ask her sometimes, what is this supposed to represent? She says, what do you see? It's what you see. And so here I used the word opportunity. I showed you what I saw. But you told me what you saw. I actually like your answer just as good or even better than mine. We all see a different prism, in ways of looking at that opportunity. Your answer is certainly as good as mine.
I like your answer. We can all agree it's a great definition, and I still like your description. But taking this as the opportunity, let's talk about how parties take advantage of this opportunity. You've once written an article about the 10 most common mistakes made by mediation advocates. But we could lump this, the advocates and the parties together in this. We could talk about the 10 common mistakes that parties make when they're in a mediation. But another way of saying it, these are common mistakes that people make in negotiations that they're in front of.
We're not going to have enough time to talk about 10, but let me see if I can't recall two or three of my favorite issues. First of all, I always start with preparation. Parties simply don't prepare. They don't talk about who really owns the dispute, who to bring into the room, who's going to be a presenter. They don't even think about the negotiations often until now, not with me. I require them because I have meetings in advance, and I talk them through all of these issues in terms of who's in the room. We're going to have to think about solutions and whether there's any opportunity for an integrative solution, or this is a pure dollars dispute. We're just distributing dollars here. Are we going to have a bid and ask process or something else? Who's going to move first? And they don't even think about that and many, many, many other issues. There's a great book, A Civil Action. I don't know if you've read it.
Book, yeah.
It's a terrible movie, I think, because it just
didn't do the job.
But if you want to see a book on the civil justice system going awry, I commend everybody reading that book. And there's a great scene when this plaintiff's lawyer has lost half of his case and has a one-time opportunity to settle the other half. He goes up to Boston to meet with the general counsel of a company. He sits around the night before with all of his colleagues, and they say, well, what should we ask for? Now they're preparing for the negotiation. And it's the same in a mediation. We're talking a negotiation. And he goes around the room, and one person says, $22 million, $14 million. They shout out numbers. And the plaintiff's lawyer said, well, why should we ask for anything less than what the case is worth? When I teach in negotiations, I use that because it reminds me of this little cartoon when I was a kid. And they said, what is wrong with this picture? The kid had one ear. He had his hat on backwards. The bow tie was askew or whatever. But there are so many things wrong with that statement because studies in negotiation clearly show that nobody who has an interest in the outcome can make an objective assessment
of
their
is.
Own case.
Right.
That's advocacy bias.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill said it best. Where you stand depends on where you sit. You can't do it. I talk about that. I do a lot of teaching in negotiations. But you need to make some best judgments, and you need to calculate where you might want to start. You need to think about if you're going to make a move, what's the other side likely to think about when they hear your move. But let me go back to the civil action. What happened in that case is they threw up their hands and they said, let's go to the mediation and we'll see what the other side does. Now imagine when both parties do that. A good mediator will manage that ahead of the process so you don't have that happen.
Which is, by the way, a common nightmare for not just in mediations, but it's a common nightmare for parties in a dispute negotiation. I don't know how many times I've faced the situation where the other side has come in and they've said, we're very open-minded. We've come here to listen. But they haven't come thinking of what they want. I guess to me, the most basic element that you want to have. I mean, we would never send a sales manager into a sales negotiation saying, you know, you're going to sell a turbine. What price did you get? Well, just get the best you can. Go listen to what the customer wants and then, you know, quote a price that you think is good. No competent sales manager is going to do that. You're going to want to know what does it cost to produce a turbine? What's a reasonable profit on that? What are the risks associated with it? But yet when you take parties in a dispute, it's remarkable. I mean, it happens even in our organization. It's remarkable how many people go into a negotiation not having defined what they want to get out of that.
All the time. And I try to avoid that by my preparation with the parties and sometimes the actual party representatives, but certainly with their counsel who are meeting with their parties in advance. We talk about this so they get this preparation going. We talk about who should make the first move. And that leads me to the next.
By the way, if you don't do it, you're missing an opportunity.
We can get back to opportunity on every one of these.
Opportunity.
Every one of these.
Finding your dispute goals.
You know, I think parties sometimes say, well, it's a mediation. It's not binding. There's no downside.
Well,
but there's no upside. You missed an opportunity.
You missed an opportunity.
Okay. So then they get into I'm going to fast forward. There's so much to talk about here. But but parties, when they make initial moves, there's a $10 million demand that's been made in advance of the mediation. I'll take that dispute. And the other party thinks that the case might be worth $4 million in I probably ought to get off of numbers because it's not going to work precisely, but the party that's paying the money often wants the demand to be made by the other side. And I think all things being equal, that's fair. And I start coaching parties because parties who are party plaintiffs sometimes have an advantage because they can pick any number they want. There's another classic negotiating error that both parties make. Nobody wants to bid against themselves. They just don't. And if a party comes in with an unreasonable offer, the other party said, well, I can't bid against that. And I think both parties fail to realize what has been shown time and time and time again. And that is that they're missing the advantage we call anchoring and adjustment. Anchoring and adjustment. You can adjust the expectations of the other side by making the first credible move. And you can move the negotiation to your zone. It shouldn't be too much because you could have a crossover and end up losing something. And you want the best outcome. But it shouldn't be insulting. And in that credible zone, if you anchor the negotiation there, you really will have an advantage. And I try to convince both parties to do that, and especially the parties paying money, because once you put monies on the table, you permit me to engage the other side. Plaintiffs often make outrageous demands. Not always, but sometimes they do. Well, you know, they're pie in the sky. They've got the advantage. The defendant starts with zero. The plaintiff can pick up any number. But if you can anchor that negotiation in your zone, another mistake that parties made is there are many ways to manage a negotiation. You can float proposals. You can float a proposal through the mediator to avoid reactive devaluation. There are a myriad.
Devaluation is for those who are the non-cognizant entity out there.
Anything that one side proposes, the other side will not trust. Therefore, I can go over to the other side.
As we explain it when we teach our negotiation classes, if it came from you, it must be bad.
It won't be trusted. So I go and I say, what do you think about this? I know it's the other side's. Well, you know, it's pretty good, but the other side will never agree, and now we're on our way. Okay. So I think that the other mistake in picking these numbers is that if you're going the route of a bid and ask, tit for tat, we call it at times. It's not just a trading of numbers.
Right.
We're communicating. You can send any signal you want. You can say, well, here's a number. We have some room to move, but we're expecting a reciprocal concession from you. And if not, we're going to back off. You can say whatever you want.
So to put this in practical terms, the example that you gave earlier was a $10 million dispute. And let's say that the plaintiff, the claimant in this case, comes in and says, and the first opening offer is pay me $10 million. It's a good faith dispute, and the liability may be all over the map. And so $10 million, and, you know, the respondent in this case may say, well, that's ridiculous. That's unreasonable.
We're not going to bid.
I'm not going to bid.
Or, all right, you're going to go in with 10 minutes.
I've made this mistake.
We're offering $27,000. We can be as ridiculous as you can be.
Right.
Now, good mediators,
I think I've committed this error.
Many do. But good meat eaters are coaches in negotiations, and they won't just be message carriers. And they're not going to carry that back. They're going to start talking about this advantage. And, you know, if they've bid $10 million and you're bidding $27,000. What do you think will happen next? It won't help if they come down to $970.
So let's say we
can bracket. We can do so many different things. But in the regular exchange, there is an advantage of making that credible move, sending a signal saying we're here, but we're here at a fair price. We're willing to listen and make that significant initial move.
Let's take this case on a $10 million dollar. They open with $10 million, which is the full amount of the demand. And let's say we've already done our assessment. We are prepared. We think that 3.5-4 million might be a good number.
Right.
All right, to settle for us. If we can get out with that, and that would be our negotiation goal. We prepared on that.
Right.
They come out with 10. We could respond by saying, "Well, we don't like that. Come back with a more reasonable number." You would say, "No, take advantage of the opportunity to anchor the negotiations and come back with a reasonable number." What should I offer? That 1, 2?
I was thinking actually 750.
750.
Because the 10 I thought was excessive, and a statement and a message. Because
the 750 is real money.
It's real money, and the message would be, this is not our final position,
but
we need you to move into our zone. This will never be an exercise in meeting in the middle. We're not going to play that game with you, and you can send lots of other messages, and you see what they do next, and then you make your decision about how much higher you'll go. But
so if they reciprocate, by coming down to say 9.
Well, let's say they came down an equal 750 in an effort to try to somehow meet in the middle and get to a 5 or 5.5 or something like that.
Which would be expensive for us.
Then that's not going to work. You might have to then move back in your next move. But I think there's so much art and science in this negotiation. There's so many other ways to manage this, including managing people, not just numbers, getting the executives together, pulling one of the lawyers aside. There's so much a mediator can do to get to see what that zone is. And once you get to where the goalposts are, an amount that represents the collective legal cost, that's a case a mediator will settle virtually every time.
So it's interesting to me is that a common error in the negotiations is the failure to see the opportunity to be the first to put a credible number on the table.
There we go.
And
you're speaking my language now. Opportunity.
Let's talk about another one of your points of mistakes, which is a preoccupation with winning. Now, well, we're litigators. We want to win. What's wrong with being preoccupied with winning? Business people want to win, too. Why can that be a mistake?
Because we need to redefine what win means. The lawyers who went to law school to learn how to try cases, a win means we won in court, and in a negotiation, I guess, we got the best negotiated result. But in an effort to get the very best negotiated result, you risk doing the deal. And if you dig deep with your own client, what the client really wants in most cases is to settle at a fair price and go on with their business. And I don't think that most advocates, or certainly many advocates in mediations don't dig deep enough to find out enough about the company and this dispute, what it really means to the company, how important it is to resolve it or not, and at what cost, and what potential there is for rehabilitating a relationship or restructuring a deal. And solving the problem is what the client really wants. So I just think that's not the way that trial lawyers tend to think. They tend to think in a litigation way that we need to marshal our facts, get our best arguments, and tell the other side why we're going to win at trial. And that's what they try to do in a mediation. And
this to me links back to your earlier point about preparation. And it seems to me that the error here is perhaps you've defined your goal as the wrong one. You've misprepared because you've defined the goal as how do you get a winning outcome rather than how do you deliver a commercial objective, and what is that objective?
And that's correct. And I think it also folds into another thing that I've talked about, which is the focus on legal positions and not the underlying interests. And everyone who understands mediations understands what that's all about. But trial lawyers aren't particularly adept, because that's not their training, to delve into these interests, to ask whether timing is important, to ask whether this dispute is linked to any strategic objective of the company. Maybe there's a merger that won't succeed as well if this dispute is not resolved. Maybe there are personal issues that you need to consider with your CEO or the person in the room representing your company. The list is just,
well,
it goes
on forever.
Well, in
fact, this leads to one of your other common mistakes that you point out, and that is a failure to listen in negotiations. Now, you hear this, and I think this is standard negotiation training that's delivered, is that good negotiators listen more than they talk. But is it true? I mean, do you really see that people don't listen in negotiations?
I mean, see it all the time. Right. And actually,
the level of negotiation,
the studies more specifically show that as a percentage of negotiating behavior, the skilled and successful negotiators, and they can measure what skill and what success, outperform the average negotiator by substantial margins by listening 2-to-1. They'll spend twice as much time listening. And information is power. So listening includes asking prompting questions. Well, what about this and what about that? And getting more information so you are empowered to make an even better decision. You know more about what the other side needs, what they want, what they'll settle for, what their number is even. You've got to listen carefully. And people just shut down. I've heard and I've talked about before what happened several times. This is not apocryphal, but parties have said, we're not prepared to make a significant move. And the other side says, we're out of here. The answer should be, it could be many things, but I would say, what do you think is significant? So people don't listen.
Missed opportunity. Another chance is if you're talking instead of listening, you may miss some opportunities that are available to you.
I think that if I could add another big mistake, it's a failure to appreciate some of the what a mediator will be looking for, and that's, what are the relationships between various different parties in a mediation? Because those relationships to me, and I wrote an article on the invisible relationships as being the principal barriers to resolution, are really critical. It's not something that is necessarily legally or logically relevant to the dispute, qua dispute, but those are certainly important settlement issues and settlement facts. And if I can present just two of those issues, relationships. There is the relationship, which I'm always looking at, between the lawyer and client. There's a professor, Jerry Williams, who's a well-known academic that writes about negotiations, that studied 22 lawyers. He studied 22 lawyers for 7 years and concluded in rank order the principal reason cases didn't settle was a disconnect in that relationship. It could be overreaching expectations or the failure to report and the client wasn't brought in or overreaching expectations, again, to hype the case to get the case. Or just the opposite.
What do you mean overreaching expectations?
When the client first walks in the door, you've got a great case, I'm going to take that case for you, I can get you this great result. And the client believes.
Unrealistic
expectations. Yeah. Or it could be that the client, the lawyer is making a reasonably good evaluation, advocacy bias notwithstanding, this can be done. And the client doesn't want to hear that news. I thought you were my client. I'll get another lawyer if you don't believe in my case. An interest in the fee is often a problem, and that list goes on. So parties and lawyers ought to be taking a close look at that. Certainly a mediator does. But even more importantly, I think there's the relationship between the multiple representatives
Within the party.
Within just one side.
Yeah, no, that's one.
Just to give one real example, I had a supply agreement breach, a very substantial amount of money to large companies, one supplying the other. It's typically the other supplied the one in another product, but in this case it was product A. And the CEO just wanted a large sum of money, readily admitted it would impact his bonus this year. The CFO was most concerned about the timing of the payment and which quarter it would hit and how it would impact reported earnings. The general counsel, who took, I think, the best view of the case, said Wall Street values long-term streams of revenue more highly than large sums of cash. Can't we restructure the relationship? The manager, who made a determination that there was a breach,
The
operational manager. She just wanted to go to court and get a declaration of rights because she made a breach. She wanted the court to say she had done the right thing. I've spent many mediations
Did you settle that one? That sounds almost impossible.
We actually settled that case, but most of the hard work was in the intramural mediation on just one side, getting them on the same page. I'd walk back to the other room occasionally to report, and they say, don't they understand their risk here, and why aren't they being reasonable? I said, just bear with me. And
because the real mediation is taking place.
I can't tell them what's exactly going on because how transparent I am depends on the issue.
Even within one side, within a party and its insurance company, for example,
right.
because there are different interests
right.
at play. One's just money and the other may be concerned about reputation.
But Michael, we're talking about mistakes in negotiations or tips for advocates in negotiations. And so this is what I see. And my suggestion out there for folks that are preparing the client is to not just take the party line from the general counsel and take some expectation of a number and go in, but dig deep to find out who owns the dispute. What does the company really want? What are some of the creative options? In that case, there was a product A. There was also product B. We abandoned the dispute and went to product B in that dispute and did a new pricing deal in product B. But you've got to ask all those questions ahead of time. It's too late once you get into the mediation room. You won't even have the right people there.
No, but you know, it's interesting that you say these things because I think a lot of people may see you work with very sophisticated, large, sophisticated companies and transactions in these disputes.
Mostly.
And I think a lot, in many of them will be them. And we're talking about mistakes that people make. And it's important for almost anyone to understand that organizations are made up of people. No matter what level you're dealing with, people make mistakes. And that's often why you have disputes, is that people are making mistakes. That organizations are not monolithic. They're complex. There's the common saying that I think that it goes around the mediation community about there being two or three great lies. Now, the three great, you've heard this, the three great lies. The first is the check is in the mail. The second, I'll love you in the morning. And the third is I have full authority to sell.
Oh, okay. I thought it was I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. That was
the four great lies. But I have the
authority is a great question
we could
spend a lot of time on that.
But who has who's calling the shots? Who has the authority? And it may be that nobody does because there's so many stakeholders on the other side, and they have different views of things.
I usually try to get to that ahead of time. I had a dispute involving a university where. A senior executive of the university rehired the head of a department, reported it in, and the I don't want to identify this entity, but the number one person in the university said, "We can't do that. You said he was such a bad person. You're going to rehire him?" Well, you weren't in the mediation room. You didn't realize I made a mistake, and I never really understood something that I understand today. You can't always bring in the ultimate authority,
right?
And yet. There are ways to really recognize it ahead of time, deal with it ahead of time. And the more you prepare ahead of time, the more you have that opportunity.
But there are always limitations on authority. And it's just that you have to be realistic. You're never
going to
have
insurance or reinsurance companies.
Nobody in my company has unlimited authority to do whatever they want.
No.
And they never will.
But you don't want the authority. You don't want the person of very limited authority coming into the room. And that kind of an agent is not going to be very helpful.
Well, what I find, actually, is you need to have somebody who has the credibility to get the authority if they need it. If that person says, I've been through this, I've seen it, they can make sure that a deal gets done.
Two sound bites on this. Two CEOs in the last 2 years have told me, I can't settle for that amount. My wife will think I'm a wimp. And the other one said, I got to settle this. I'm keeping my wife up. I'm so angry. I got to settle this at any price. True stories, major companies, and talk about the people behind the scenes and other stakeholders. It's not even just the party representatives.
But their wives, and in this case, one driving.
So when
one
you
direction.
Say it's about personalities, if the mediator digs deep enough, you'll find out all of these personalities and issues and barriers.
And draw them out and hopefully find
the process has some, it's almost magic at times.
Yeah, you remember what happened in a civil action? Because they let's go back to your example of preparation. They shoot up a bunch of numbers. They then say, let's ask for the amount that the case is worth. He goes up and as it's described in the book, if I remember correctly, goes to the negotiation, and they don't settle.
They don't settle.
And it's a disaster for the plaintiffs.
Plaintiff's lawyer loses his car at the end, has no life. He, by the way, has come back and now lectures on if I only mediated that case.
Really?
He has been a convert to mediation.
I can imagine, yeah.
The actual person who was the plaintiff's lawyer in that case.
One final mistake that you see parties typically making in a dispute negotiation, and that you say that they don't come to the negotiation or the mediation or the negotiation with a draft of a settlement agreement. Why is that? By the way, I'm a big sinner here because I don't think I've ever come in with a pre-prepared settlement agreement. Why is that a mistake?
Well, no mediator will permit the parties to walk out of a room after a settlement without at least a binding term sheet. And at the very least, you need to have that. Because without it, there may be remorse later, failure to recall what it was you did agree to, or disagreement about it, or some challenge in the back room. You did what at the mediation? So if everyone agrees, let's at least get a binding term sheet. And let's at least, if we can't get a more fulsome agreement, get all of the items and some non-economic items that you may need on that sheet. So you get a binding agreement, and then parties will almost always, 99.8% of the time, that agreement will flow from that writing. Without it, there are always problems, some problems. And so I ask parties every time to bring that agreement, and parties never do. The lawyers never do, with some few exceptions, because I think they always believe this case won't really settle. And then we burn lots of time, and we try to find out what are all the issues at great expense. And we're often tired. It could be at midnight when we're doing this. So it's just not productive.
Well, you know, it also sounds...
It's another opportunity.
It's an opportunity. So to go back to is if you do this in advance of the mediation, if you write out the settlement agreement that you would like to see, you might actually see some opportunities that you can take advantage of in the course of the mediation.
I agree.
Back to preparation and opportunity. Well, this was a great opportunity to be able to sit down and talk to you about mediation and negotiations and what's effective. Thanks so much.
Michael, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.